and I am with the Office of Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful. On this week's episode, we are going to jump into a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, Judaism and race. We're going to talk to Yavila McCoy, one of the most brilliant people to talk about this subject. It should be a really illuminating and interesting conversation, definitely something that's come up in the news a lot recently, so really excited to hear what Yavila has to say. So without further ado, to this week's conversation. So I am joined today by Yavila McCoy, educational consultant, and one of the leaders in sort of the talking about Judaism, race, Jewish social justice, someone I've long admired from afar and really excited to have you today. Yavila, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm also joined by, for those of you who have listened to other episodes, by Hannah Leffingwell, one of our most common student guests. Hannah, do you mind just quickly introducing yourself?
I'm Hannah. I'm a PhD student here at NYU, and I study French and history, and I'm happy to be here.
Great. So, Yavila, we're recording this right after you received an award from JFRJ, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, for some of the work you've done. So I'm curious if you could maybe, just to start us off, give us a little bit about your background and your own biography as to how you get here and sort of what is the work that you do on a day-to-day basis for people who don't know, and then we can kind of jump into some of the topics from there.
Okay. So the most current thing that I'm doing, I'm the CEO of a corporation called Visions Incorporated. And Visions has 37 consultants working nationally and internationally on issues of anti-oppression, diversity, and justice and equity work. Our work really is about building relationships, helping people to translate the work of isms into actual behaviors, behaviors that we can actually name and address and then reach for alternatives around, so that we get to have each other differently around the isms that sometimes separate us. So this is work that's been done for the past 30 years. My Visions was founded by three African-American women psychologists who really did some good thinking and created some really beautiful tools that I'm really happy to be shepherding through the world right now. My history, I'm an African-American Jewish woman. I've been doing the work of anti-racism for about 20 years. And I think that work started when I was on a college campus and Kwame Ture, who Stokely Carmichael, and we had, what's his name now? Meir Kahane. Meir Kahane's son. I don't remember his name, but Meir Kahane's son was coming to campus. And there were signs that went up around campus that said, every Jew at 22, and Zionism is racism. And Stokely Carmichael followed him with basically a speech that said that in order for Black students on campus to remain in solidarity with the movement, they needed to specifically target Zionism. So this was about 25 years ago this happened. And when that happened on the campus, I was leading. I was the president of the NAACP, and I was the educational director of Hillel. I had done that in my junior and sophomore years. And so as a leader on campus, I was kind of caught in friction. Right. And the intersectionality that I carry actually became relevant to how we were going to address issues on campus. And that was the beginning of my journey of doing this work. From there, I started working with World of Difference. I became a World of Difference facilitator. I invited National Coalition Building Institute to come to campus and continue to work with them from Washington around mediation work. And then I became an educator, actually, in Jewish schools, teaching both Judaic studies and English. And then when the World of Difference started to evolve and when I write curriculum, I started writing curriculum for them. And that began the journey of me being a diversity consultant. So there is curriculum that exists right now within a World of Difference that has my name on it. And then there's also the expansive work beyond that that I did for DRI, which is the Dismantling Racism Institute. And from there, I started thinking very specifically about what this work needs to look like for Jews. I was doing a lot of work in the broad sphere. And when I started thinking about what the work needs to look like for Jews, I founded an organization called IYECA. IYECA specifically dealt with the issues of Jews of color, advocating for their needs, and also educating about the broad world of Jewish diversity. I received the Joshua Venture Fellowship to broaden my work in IYECA, ran that organization for about 8 years, Then my husband matched for residency in medical school, and it was time for me to stop working 90 hours a week, even though that doesn't even seem possible. But right. With a resident in my home, that wasn't possible. And so I leveraged that work to partners so that they could continue the work. And then I started working for Bronfman Philanthropies, doing diversity and cultural identity work on private school campuses. Through an organization called TCI. And then from TCI, I started working for Combined Jewish Philanthropies. This seems like a long journey, but
definitely
in each of these spaces, what I'm doing actually is standing up for cultural identity and inclusion across multiple isms. So I worked on issues of inclusion specifically for CJP around issues of disability when I was there, though it broadened into broader diversity issues that could be a part of how we service Jewish community in a federation and in a federated system. So that was what I did before I came to Visions. And then after doing that and launching the Synagogue Inclusion Project, which helped synagogues to think strategically about issues of inclusion, I decided to take an offer that was made to me by Visions. The founder, who was there for 30 years, approached me and looked at the background that I'm describing to you right now and said, we need you here to help us think about what the next steps are for this wonderful organization that's been doing this work. And we want you to help us to be strategic about making it grow. And so I stepped in as the very first director beyond the founding director of Visions. And that is where I am now.
So I'm curious because, so just yesterday from when we're recording this, this will be about a week after when this goes up, journalist at The Atlantic, who I really like, Emma Green, who's actually been on this podcast before, wrote an article that has stirred up some controversy online, and then she wrote a follow-up about, like, are Jews white?
Uh-huh.
And so I this is sort of what I want to talk about, because I think growing up, for me, I grew up without really thinking about race, because I think I saw myself as white.
Yep.
And so So I think there are two sides to this coin. I want to start with your work in getting the Jewish community to be more open to accepting of reaching out to Jews of color. Can you tell us a little bit about what that process has been like? What are some of the projects you've worked on and sort of in your work, like how well does the Jewish community reach out to its members of color now, sort of the organized Jewish community?
So it's a long story. And what I'll start with is the idea that whiteness is a construct almost as much as blackness is. And if we realize that, then what we're really looking for are what are the societal structures that we've lived through as Jews that have helped us to understand ourselves and our power and our privilege in relation to the construct called race. And I think when Jews first came to this country, the construct of race and Jewishness being a part of that spectrum was still very real. In the context of the way the founders of the Reform Movement, in the way in which we were spoken about this island of New York, and whether Jews were going to get the opportunity to be able to do business here, you hear people talking about Jews as a race.
Right. And Judaism was sort of a marker of non-whiteness
in
that case.
And the idea of Jews being a part of what was trying to be established in this country as a binary of black and white actually was a problem for our country for a long time. Mm-hmm. There was something literally called the Jewish problem as government started to figure out what do we do about this middle ground, actually, that this people seems to hold. They're not quite white, and we don't want to call them quite black. So what are they? Mm-hmm. how internally we've translated that, I think, has been more about where we've needed access. Because in places like the South, where Jews created communities and really needed to be able to be seen as part of the white spectrum in order to function in segregated society, whiteness became really important. Mm-hmm. And in the ways that anti-Semitism could rise and endanger our communities if our politics were not correct, whiteness became very important. In the North, in cities where there was a little bit more integration, I wouldn't say that racism wasn't just as alive and well in the North, but in the spaces where there's a little bit more integration, Jews and blacks did tend to live with one another. Mm-hmm. And so you found organizations evolving, and you found people thinking about whiteness differently and championing Jewishness and the race piece of Jewishness differently. B'nai B'rith, if you think about B'nai B'rith and the way B'nai B'rith was founded, we founded B'nai B'rith because we saw ourselves to be different on many different college campuses and the context of our access and institutions. And so we needed spaces where racially we could come together and support one another. Now, over time, that identity evolved.
Right.
And I think that is the key to how we understand ourselves today around the issue of race. Blackness hasn't been given as much leeway to be on the spectrum as Jewishness has in regard to the black-white stratification. For people who are identified, you know, phenotypically as black, you stay black. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the sayings that's alive in the black community. You know, there's two things you have to do, pay taxes and be black and die, right? So you, that's one of the things that doesn't change about you if you identify phenotypically. Right. Now, if there's been intermarriage, if there's been, you come from a multiracial family, yes, the gradations of the color of your skin and the way your physical features manifest, you could move along a spectrum mm-hmm. toward physically being seen as white, but what we require is a phenomenon called passing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You come from black people, but you'd have to start to deny that and start to tell people that you're closer to white. I think that same phenomena has happened among us as Jews. Maybe not discussed as much as it's been discussed in the black community,
for sure.
But I have friends who tell stories of what it meant to make that journey from Jewishness being a distinctive way to identify around your body, mm-hmm. meaning in mm-hmm. your nose,
right.
in your lips, in your hair, in our hips as women,
mm-hmm.
In the tenor of our voice
and that's
our
sort of
language.
Where we see a lot of images mm-hmm. of like traditional anti-Semitism also
yes.
is focused on those features.
Yeah, it's in the body in
right.
anti-Semitism. But if we're talking about how Jews identify themselves, you're getting into the realm of something called internalized oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we internalize those messages about those physical ways that made us different, we actually did things. I was at a women's conference once, and one of the questions was, this is a room full of majority Ashkenazi women, how many of you have had surgery to alter your body?
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite surprised for 75% of the hands of the women. Now, these were women over 40, so I would hope that mm-hmm. under 40, some of this may have changed with more of the women's liberation work and
mm-hmm.
how it has impacted women, but 75% of
wow.
the women's hands went up around either having had surgery to alter their noses or had surgery in some way to make their physicality look different. And what that said to me is that when we're talking about race and the way with race like impacts bodies of
mm-hmm.
Jews, it's very real that whiteness has had impact on us and
yeah.
has helped us to be able to do different things to try to show up as white in the world for the sake of getting access. So you asked me, how does it impact us? I think it impacts us on multiple levels. And it's not just limited to race. I think it's an issue of race, class, and gender.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been talking a lot about this in a wonderful and concise way about the history of Judaism and a little bit of blackness in the United States. But I wanted to ask a question about the moment that we're in right now and what is changing and what isn't changing. I think for some of us who have certain privileges based on race, gender, class, ability, it feels like a wake-up call, like, oh, things are wrong. And for others, it's things have always been wrong. What's new about that? It may be a new manifestation, but it's not any different, the work we're doing. So I wanted to pose that question to you of what is different and what is the same in your kind of goals moving forward?
So my goal is for us to be, as they're saying now in the movement, woke. That's all. Like, we should be walking through the world awake. And one of the challenges of privilege across the spectrum of isms is that it causes you to, in some ways, be asleep.
Mm.
You have to be asleep in order to take access that's granted to you that's denied to others, because you'd feel bad about that access if you knew it was only being granted to you and there were so many others who are deserving and who aren't getting the same. So the ways in which we allow that sleep to settle on us has come upon us through segregation, has come upon us through absence of contact with each other, through the inability to do self-focus about how we come to have what we have,
mm-hmm.
and what's important about building equity into that. So there's various ways in which we've not had reason to be woke. In these times, I think that privilege is slowly deteriorating because of how visible and present and centered the issues of white supremacy, misogyny, the Islamophobia. There are various isms that are now, I think, being given permission to take up space in our society and be visible with the question of whether we will offer them as an American society legitimacy. That's a question. So what's new is it is now upon each of us to answer that question. Is this how we're going to proceed forward to say that there's an equal sign between being American and these isms? And I think that's deep. And I think that's really important as a Jewish community for us to be paying attention to, given our history. And I think what we've been talking about earlier about this work of taking real seriously where we've been given the opportunity to pass as Jews is relevant to that. Because if we're going to talk about this moment, we're going to have to talk about what have we given up in order to be American. And when people say that this is what America is, and it doesn't include our history in ways that we personally also may have denied our history, what are we going to do about that?
Do you have an example for what one of those things might be? Because I have thought about, I think, race more in the last 2 or 3 years than in the first 25 years of my life combined. And I have thought much more consciously about how I can or cannot pass as white and sort of the role that my yarmulke plays in that decision. And so I'm curious how you would evaluate, like, as a Jewish community, maybe what have or have not people given up in passing or choosing not to pass
as white? So one of the things that I think is fascinating, I was here, I think now it's 2 weeks ago, participating on the ADL's summit on anti-Semitism. It's interesting to me that we have not yet figured out how to talk about anti-Semitism in the context of racism, given our history. When anti-Semitism began, it was about the Jewish blood and Jewish body being polluted, being less than in some way. It was physical. In the way in which we have come to talk about anti-Semitism in 2016, it's about those evil people. It's not necessarily about how the Jewish body has been targeted in very specific ways across history. That is extremely similar to how black bodies are being targeted in the present. And so the inability to make that synaptical connection between anti-Semitism and racism, to me, is a sign of what we've given up. We've gone to the intellectual as opposed to the visceral in regard to how we fight isms. And I think that's deep for us right now to grapple with. It is extremely important for us to understand anti-Semitism as a body. It is a way in which Jewish bodies have been and continue to be targeted. And in the ways that we create hierarchies of value between bodies, we are engaged in isms that we all have to fight. And that puts us in line with all the other identities that are right now struggling for survival, we as Jews. And if we're going to do that work, we're going to have to do a little bit more internal introspection about what has our journey has been as a people and what it has to do with the moment we're in right now.
So I would imagine if you took the average, let's say, Federation employee or the average employee at sort of a mainstream Jewish organization and asked them to give, like, a thoughtful, coherent response, like how they approach Jewish pluralism, they'd have a lot to say. Or like how they approach a relationship to Israel, they'd have a lot to say. If you ask them how they approach, like, race and not, I guarantee you they don't have a lot to say. And so my question is, like, how do you, what types of things are you doing in your work are you doing to try and have these conversations? Because I've been in Jewish environments my entire life, and I had to come to a university as an employee to begin having these conversations in a serious way. And I think that's a problem.
Well, when I talk about reclaiming our history, I'm serious about that. And one of the things that I do, having been a part of a federated system and also working with JCCs and federations often, is to remind people that if I were to snap my fingers and bring every Jew that exists in the world right now into any room with us, the Jewish people would look more like the United Nations than the United Nations itself. And the reason that is true is because whiteness actually is a minority identity. Mm-hmm. The people of the global majority are people of color. Mm-hmm. And if we were to talk seriously about what our majority looks like as a Jewish people, we are not white. We are people from Djerba, from Morocco, from Africa, from Yemen, from Tunisia. We are from places where people are brown. Mm-hmm. And those people are alive and vibrant in our history and in what we've become as a people. The fact that we can talk about Jewish continuity or that we can talk about Jewish peoplehood and not acknowledge that we are diverse and multicultural as a people is a function of the way we've had to access privilege and power by taking on the identity of whiteness. Mm-hmm. So in the federated systems, what I say to people is, who is we? When we say we, who do we mean? And are we being fully inclusive of the full body of the Jewish people in how we raise funds, allocate funds, think about the disbursement of funds, mm-hmm. create opportunities for leadership, mm-hmm. open up spaces for empowerment and support? We have to be talking about our full body. And if we are talking about our full body, then we start to speak about what are the needs of Jews of color and have Jews of color experience their Jewish identity in the context of a Jewish system that in some ways operates from a place of erasure.
Mm-hmm. I think what's really interesting about the way you're talking about this is it's making me think about the backlash we're seeing against identity politics. Mm-hmm. So many editorials that are being written right now saying that the left has failed because there's been too much emphasis on identity. Mm-hmm. And we need to do away with these kind of marginal, particular things, because of course those are just those people, you know, we don't need to worry about them. Kumbaya. And go back to the center of America, the white working class, which is very, I mean, frustrating on so many levels and really hard to hear. But I'm kind of wondering, how can we use that aspect of finding a community that you already belong to and realizing it's much more diverse than you thought it was, mm-hmm. outside of just Jewishness, but in other ways, like how can people access that feeling of realizing that it's something that's been there all along that they just haven't been seeing?
So one thing that I say, at least in Jewish space, and then I'll deal with the broader space, mm-hmm. most people, when they meet me and they'll say, wow, how are you Jewish? Like, it's so interesting. Mm-hmm. How long have you been Jewish, right? And when I start to answer those questions, it's almost more interesting to hear their story than mine. Mm-hmm. Because I'm three generations in with this. I'm probably more Jewishly literate, educated, and I've been a Jewish community professional for so long. Like, I'm about as Jewish as it gets, right? So it's not some new, exotic, interesting story. What's interesting usually in this conversation is, why is there this assumption that you've been living with that to be mm-hmm. Jewish and not white is what's exotic, mm-hmm. as opposed to be Jewish plus whatever the plus is actually what's interesting about the mm-hmm. fact that we get to be in relationship. So what I've been focusing on lately is asking people to dig deeper into what does it mean to be in relationship with people, mm-hmm. by taking the full dimension of what we bring to our relationships around identity seriously. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean identity politics. Mm-hmm. That means saying to you that in our relationship, it's important for me to know enough about you, mm-hmm. to be able to have you fully and to be able to work with you fully in a way that makes equity between us. If I'm saying we can be friends, but all we can talk about is the fact that we come to this office every day, mm. and that's it. The rest of it needs to stay off of the table. We're going to be able to work together, but the full dimension of what we have to offer each other as leaders, as people who are trying to bring our talents to a project, may also be left off of the table. So to me, it's more the relational piece. It's not necessarily that you have to be a woman and you have to be a man and I have to be a black in order for us to have a very specific conversation. Mm-hmm. It's that we have to be in relationships that allow for all of that to come up organically and naturally without there being put stops, you know, without there being, mm-hmm. you know, borders, without there being demarcation lines around how we get to express our full identities. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And that's more to me about us really honing and mining the full talent of what it means to be human, mm-hmm. than it is about putting us into different boxes and speaking from those boxes. Mm-hmm. Now, there's another piece of this work that's important too, which is that it is important to create those lines for the purposes of empowerment. when you've right. never got a full picture right. of mm-hmm. yourself because of the demarcation mm-hmm. lines, it was never real okay to talk about being queer. Mm-hmm. It was never really okay to talk about being woman. It never was really okay to talk about being Black. Mm-hmm. There's a piece of yourself that you have never seen fully. Mm-hmm. You have not seen what it looks like out in the world with sunlight. And so to be able to create spaces where people can get together and get a full picture of themselves and see their real power mm-hmm. is important so that they can come back to the conversation with their power intact. Mm-hmm. And so in that regard, it's very important to speak specifically to identity groups mm-hmm. and to give people spaces to be able to do that. And when we talk about Jewish systems, mm-hmm. 100%. I mean, we do that in federated systems all the time. Mm-hmm. Young people get put in a box. Mm-hmm. Russians get put in a box, right? The unaffiliated get put in a box. Our boardrooms are boxes in some ways in terms of the way we allocate our resources, our thinking, our services. How interesting would it be if we flipped that and said, rather than us deciding who gets to be the recipient of our attention, why don't we just ask a broad question? Who would like to gather to be able to pay attention to what their Jewish identity has to do with what they want to bring to Jewish community? And we fund that. Mm. That would be so interesting. And yet, that is not how we are thinking right now.
So I wanna ask about the flip side of the coin, because I think we've kind of been talking about the ways Jews are not or have passed as white. And I think one of the things that's emerged in conversations, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement in, I think, the last sort of 2 years has been the Jewish community not really knowing how to engage mm-hmm. with the Black Lives Matter movement, or a lot of the Jewish community not knowing how to engage. And that sort of has to do with, I think, two things. And you can correct whatever part of this characterization you might not agree with, because I'm not totally sure I'm right. Mm-hmm. But it seems like one is that there's a lack of fluency within the Jewish world in being able to talk about certain systems of power, privilege, oppression. At least the mainstream Jewish world would not feel comfortable talking about anti-Jewish racism as a body. Like, the way you were just talking about it, I have a feeling for listeners who are Jewish, a lot of that's going to sound foreign to them. Mm-hmm. And then two, I think there has been, in probably the last 30 or 40 years, a conflation of Israel and Zionism with colonialism mm-hmm. and whiteness. Mm-hmm. And that has created a very large sort of a sense of almost like an inverse anti-Semitism on the left, or a very different form of thinking that Jews cannot be allies in certain things because they're so deeply tied to a system of oppression also. That sentiment is actually almost the exact opposite of what you'll get from like David Duke in response to that article, are Jews white, just retweeted it with like, absolutely not, right? Like that, so those two are sort of two ends of a spectrum of where Jews fit in the image. I'm curious, so when Jewish people are engaging with the Black Lives Matter movement or with any sort of system, anti-oppression movement, how should they go about it? How do they go about it in being true allies and also sort of being able to have conversations about like, actually this view you have about Judaism is more complicated for X, Y, and Z? How do you go about sort of talking about certain views that people may have? Because I know the Black Lives Matter platform caused a big, at least in my Facebook world, it was a really big discussion point over what that means for the relationship between Jews and Black people.
So it's so interesting. I spent this year, this past year.
I'm sure you were asked about this a ton.
Yeah, because I went to 20, I'm a consultant for International Hillel. So I went to 25 different campuses really to speak to issues of how can Jews who are committed to social justice engage in the fervor of what's happening around the Black Lives Movement on campuses. And what you described actually is real. This is real time, what I've heard from some students around coming to a protest or trying to join in a discussion or dialogue or conversation and being rebuffed around a feeling or a perception that people are coming from a privileged space and coming from a space of not having decentered whiteness in themselves and wanting to participate in the conversation without having considered what their role is in the conversation itself. So what's interesting to me is this discussion we're having, and that I've mentioned a little bit about internalized anti-Semitism. Mm. If David Duke saying Jews are not white is the first time that Jews are considering what the relationship is between Jewish and whiteness. What we're doing is allowing an anti-Semite to be able to set the pace for our liberation around issues of race in Jewish community. The real question is, if Jews are not white, what are they? That's the question we should have been asking even before David Duke tweeted it. Because then we are in charge of our own liberation. We are not reactive having this discussion as a result of how we're going to deal with that anti-Semite. We are saying, how do we walk through the world? How does race impact how a Jew walks through the world? Now, when I ask that question on a college campus, I say to students, if you had answered that question 2 weeks before you went to that protest, you'd have something to say. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have the people at the protest asking you a question that you have no answer for that now is making you uncomfortable and making you feel as if that question itself is anti-Semitic because in some way it rejects you. Mm-hmm. The rejection is of the lack of consciousness. It is not of the body. So if in my body I am walking around with a sense of my own liberation as a Jew, I know where I come from. I know what my connection to social justice is. I know what my connection is to race. I know what it has to do with why I'm here at this protest. And I'm here because I need to do this for me. Mm-hmm. That whole evolution is about being able to walk with a sense of awareness mm-hmm. and a sense of being awoke, right? Awake as a Jew. Now, if we're waiting to be reactive to what's happening in the world right now, we're going to miss a moment. And this is work that has to be...
I think we are missing a moment.
But this is lifetime journeying. The answers to these questions are lifetime journey specific. Every person has an evolutionary journey about understanding mm-hmm. what it means to be able to address isms and to be able to be in relationship with isms in a way that doesn't feel discounting. But you have to be thinking about it every day because the messages of who is up and who mm-hmm. is down are coming at you all the time. And what privilege teaches you is that's not your business. That's those targeted people's business. Mm. That's what privilege teaches you. So giving up privilege as Jews would be to pay attention. You know, if I had on something that would identify me as Jewish right now, whether it be a kippah or a star, would my interactions right now be different? Have I tested that? Do I understand what that means? And in some spaces where whiteness actually is pretty prevalent, I've done a lot of work on Ivy League campuses. Mm-hmm. I've heard some of these stories about the difference between way students are treated when they're wearing a kippah mm-hmm. and heading into a Hillel and when they're not and passing. Mm-hmm. So to really pay close attention to what that looks like and whether your friends actually have some feelings about Jews that you've never heard before, mm-hmm. whether you're in spaces where silently people are saying we're all white and Christian and wealthy, whether all of these things are in place is really relevant right now, even before you address what happened with Black Lives Matter. Now, let's go to Black Lives Matter because I think our absence in the spaces of the racial justice work mm-hmm. has impact. There's something called the Race Forward Conference that I've been going to for the last, you know, it's every 2 years, so I'd say over the last 5 years or so, I've been going to. And in the first year that I went to Race Forward, it was myself and a colleague, a Jewish colleague, sitting around felling, ooh, wouldn't it be great mm-hmm. if Jewish conferences looked like this? So I came back into the community to talk about that with many of people that I consider to be partners. And this year, we brought a contingent. There was a contingent of Jews of color that went to Race Forward in Atlanta, and also another contingent that was organized by Repair the World that went. Mm-hmm. Now, what was interesting is when the Repair the World contingent was majority white, there were some Jews of color there. Our contingent was majority Jews of color, because I organize it. Mm-hmm. But the experience, you know, we had opportunities where the two groups could coalesce and speak. The experience for some of the white Jews that I heard from my Black colleagues in some of these conversations were ones where people were saying, I'm trying to figure out what my entry point is to this. Mm-hmm. And people who were facilitating were saying, you need to have figured out your entry point to this mm-hmm. to be able to process what I'm teaching. Mm. So that synaptical miss mm-hmm. actually has impact.
Right.
In the context of the Black Lives Matter movement, where people talking about things like global militarization, mm-hmm. and then Israel comes up underneath an understanding of what it means to stop global militarization, you have to have thought about Israel in the context of global militarization and the impact of global militarization on countries where people of color live. If the first time you're thinking about that is in the context of somebody making a comment about Israel, you're not adequately prepared to come into that conversation before we get to whether we agree with language.
Right.
So that's really important. The other piece is that the Black Lives Matter movement itself seems to have started in response to the need for people of color to love themselves deeply in this moment, to be able to envision a world without racism. It centers blackness. And so there's not going to be a whole lot of room in there for people not to have thought about whiteness when you have a bunch of people who are trying to center blackness. So I went to the BLM convening. I went to the Black Lives Matter convening, the first one in Cleveland, where the people began to write the platform that was released. And what all of those people that were sitting in the room doing that were saying is that this is a labor of love. Now watch the impact that there were no, I guess, institutionally associated, Jewishly affiliated, people with power and access to tell a story different than what was being heard from some of the people that were engaged in this. And thinking about what happened in Ferguson and the fact that Palestinians were tweeting ways to respond to tear gas to Black activists on the street. The information that they had was that part of this labor of love is also working on Palestinian liberation.
Right.
What was missing is how does the story of Jewish liberation connect to the story of Palestinian liberation, connect to the story of Black liberation? People being present in the spaces where those conversations were happening would have made all the difference. Are not being present left a story half told. With that information, we still have to understand that what people are doing is a labor of love and a labor to dismantle oppression that hurts all of us, and that we have to approach the conversation both with the commitment to doing our work and to bringing the story of Jewish liberation to fore. If we're not doing both of those things, our presence in that doesn't do anything but replicate the issues of white supremacy that required the conversation to begin with, which is that the voices that need to be privileged in any moment are the voices that continue to collude with situations where whites and white thinking and white power continues to stay in place. So these are the things that complicate what it means to talk about Black Lives Matter right now. It is not simple, but it is all about showing up and showing up differently from where I sit.
So for a listener who's not, this is sort of the first time they've thought about Judaism, race, whiteness, blackness. Can you point to, whether it's book, online resources, just something for people to learn more? Because this has only been a half an hour, 40-minute conversation. And there's only so much we can learn. So I'm curious if you have a few go-to resources you can point people to for like ways that they can continue to learn more.
There's a book called The Price of Whiteness. That is a good book to take a look at. It does the history of some of what I've been describing to you about what the price of whiteness has been to Jewish community. That's one that I would suggest. A lot of people are reading Ta-Nehisi Coates' book right now. I would say read the book, but don't stop at Ta-Nehisi Coates' story. Look to be proximate to how these issues are impacting communities. The other thing that I would say that's real important right now is to be engaged in dialogue with people who are different than you. Don't sit in a room full of white Jews talking about race. Find some way to speak across race with people who have very different stories and journeys than your own. Not to have those people teach you, but so that you can be exposed to the impact of your perspective. I like books. I think books are great, but we're really good at books as Jews. You know, we do the intellectual really well.
People of the book.
What we yes, we are people of the book. What we're not as good at is getting proximate and dealing with the feelings that come up as we try to get proximate. And I think people around us, especially if you live in New York, there are people around you that have stories that should be a part of your narrative, even if it's just coffee or lunch or 10 minutes, look into somebody's face and say, I'm interested in seeing you. I'm interested in hearing you. I want to know you a little better. Would it be okay for us to sit down and make that your book? Like, that's what I would say is most important right now. Because when people are relational with one another, it's harder for us to deny each other. Mm-hmm. It's harder for us to make policies, for us to be blind, for us to say, this is them, not me. When you know somebody.
Right.
When somebody's in your life. And they don't have to be your best friend or married to your cousin. What they have to be is just somebody who you know more than just on the surface. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm encouraging people to do right now. Be relational. Right.
Sounds like good life advice in a time where we're more polarized than ever regardless.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to need it. Because when we're being told from the front certain people don't matter, you're going to have to be the one to say why those certain people actually do matter.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have the stories to be able to back it up.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you. This has been great. I hope listeners find it as interesting as I did. we really appreciate your time and for coming.
My pleasure.
And Hannah, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially to thank Hannah for joining and to Yavila for being an outstanding guest and for helping coordinate what was complicated timing for recording the podcast. Thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We look forward to having you back for another episode in 2 weeks.